This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Martin Walls. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Martin Walls is a Witter-Binner Fellow here at the Library, and he's going to introduce himself with an opening poem.
Snail. It is a flattened shell, the color of spoiled milk, a bold swirl slowly stirred that charts the age of what's curled inside with the tension of a watch spring, a creature that embodies the history of metaphysics. First it exists, then it doesn't, then it emerges once again, unrolls one, then another ice stalk, periscopes breaking the surface of its wet life. And here's the tongue body, the petal body, molding its shape to the world's shape.
That's Martin Walls, and we're at the Library of Congress honoring him because he's a Witter-Binner Fellow, chosen by the Laureate of the United States. How did Ted Kooser find you?
Well, he found me actually because of that poem, I believe. That's what he told me. That poem was originally published in a magazine called Third Coast, and Ted told me that he was published in that edition. And he wanted to use that poem in his book, the Poetry Home Repair Manual.
Which he has used and mm-hmm. which I have taught.
Yes, and I have taught from it too.
And using your poetry is just a lot of fun.
That was originally, this was before the Witter-Binner Fellowship. That was, to me, a marvelous achievement and a wonderful thing for him to do. And then a few months, I believe, later, he calls me with the other news. But he had trouble finding me because there's another fellow in England called Martin Walls, and he originally went after him. I believe he's a math professor.
Oh my, you were living in England.
No, I was living in America, but this fellow was on the web, had a website, and Ted tells me that he spent a couple of months trying to track that Martin Walls down. So it's a fairly rare name. So
we've got the real Martin Walls
here. I am the real Martin
Walls. And that first poem came from what book?
That first poem is from my second book called Commonwealth,
right,
published by March Street Press.
March Street Press. They do some really fine books.
Yes,
I saw
absolutely.
Others. And tell us about the cover. My husband was fascinated with this cover.
Well, Robert Bixby, the editor, chose this. It was our second choice, and he originally had a... I write a lot about...
Well, describe the cover, since this is radio.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it is radio, of course. The cover is two diesel locomotives hooked together. And they're sort of black and white locomotives, and I thought it was particularly apt because the two subjects I like to write about are insects and small animals and locomotives and machines.
Oh, I wondered why you chose it, right.
And originally we had a small animal, I believe, a newtor, a small lizard on the cover. I didn't really like that, so he came back with this, and immediately I loved it. And of course, my baby son loves trains, so I thought, well, that's... And this book is dedicated to him.
It's a great cover, great book. Commonwealth by Martin Walls. He comes to us by way of Brighton.
Brighton in England,
Brighton, yes. England. And we'll find out about that odyssey right after the next poem. This is coming out of Commonwealth too, right?
Yes, and this is called A Map of Great Britain Excluding Scotland.
Love that.
I put the newspaper down, my hands resting before me. They become Newquay, the small fishing town in Cornwall. The fingers of one hand, granite cliffs dipped in the Irish Sea. Those on the other, sand that arcs around the bay. I am full of coal. I am riddled with smugglers' caves. Things have been hidden in me for centuries. The nation sends down brave men to find them. I am a grass-covered bridge in Northumberland, across which soldiers and priests marched to Scotland, on which I've seen sheep dead of cold and hunger, crows growing black on the eclipse of their eyes. I'm a Roman road, a Saxon church, a broken city wall, a heavy forest saved from the axe by the king, where the barn owl roars at dusk. The gate is shut, the cattle home. I lay my head. In my blood, the shunt and shuttle of traffic and people, my friends are trying to escape. My backbone is the London to Brighton line that for 30 years carried my father to the government. My brother lives in Gypsy Hill. I hear him kick off his shoes and pick up the phone in my heart. When I was young, there was a girl who was a beach for me. Southold Beach in Suffolk, a place of fine sand, climbing dog rose. She was the beach. Crabs danced on her breasts. The sun rose between her legs and died in her eyes. Happiness was just another title in the bookstore. Light bleached, besotted with dust, too dear. I take great memory strides. One step, I'm in the wide, winding streets in the hills above Swansea. Another, I'm in Oxford. Another, and it's Sunday morning, Camden Town. One more, and I'm in Diss, the market town in Norfolk, where two great swans become my shoulder blades, and my arms, the rivers, Waveney and Yare.
I adored submerging myself and immersing myself in the English feel of this book, and especially the tales from being a youngster and growing up in the different places and what you ate at school. And I got so involved with it. It was like a high level of gossip from Europe, you know.
Yes.
And yet there is an interior life that comes out of that, of course. And from your geography becomes, I get a very strong identity of you. And then, which our listeners will find soon, you go into detail, detail, detail. So we go from the stacks of England down into the centipede and the snail and the ant, and we'll be hearing some of those poems.
Yes.
But you come from, make it very large,
and
then you get microscopic in this book. Was that intentional?
That is broadly intentional. I'm maybe unusual in that you sort of described I have a very... some of my poems have a very wide focus. And those poems can be quite political, not political in a polemic kind of way, but political as a way to describe the world I grew up in, which even in England was a different world.
And it's more commentary than polemic, I would
say. More, and history.
It is historical,
yes. Yes.
What years were you growing
up?
Well,
and it's not so long ago, which is the odd thing. It was, I grew up in the 1970s. I was born in 1970, and I left England in the year, well, I was about 21. So
tell us about your odyssey then to the States, why you came here.
Well, originally I came to the States first with my family on vacation a long time ago, about 1981. And in fact, I visited Washington, D.C. for the first time then. And the country, frankly, blew my mind. I was only 11 years old, and of course, it was, you know, America was something of a mecca to a young person growing up in England then. Then years later, I got onto the American and English Literature and American Studies program at the University of East Anglia in England, which was a...
That was your college?
Yes, that was my college. And that was a groundbreaking program, and although it's common nowadays, then the idea of having a year abroad for study was very new. And I did that year abroad, and I went to Trinity College in Connecticut.
I know it, I do.
And which is where I first took creative writing lessons. And my interest in writing poetry got stronger and stronger and stronger. And to be quite frank, after I left college, there wasn't really much work. There was high unemployment. And I simply used poetry as a way to get back to the United States, and I was lucky enough to get onto the program at Purdue University.
We are happy to have you. Welcome aboard. So Martin Walls, he's reading from his new book, Commonwealth, and we're at the Library of Congress. What will you read us next?
Well, I'll read one of those historical poems, and actually this poem is called, I said I don't write political poems, but I've written a series called The Socialist Poems.
Oh, yeah.
And the socialist poems, this is an attempt to describe really my biography as part of the social and political scene growing up, which was came to an end during Margaret Thatcher's reign. She really changed our country so terrifically that you know, one way of life, as far as I can see, came to an end and a new one started. But the way of life before was, you know, we lived in a quite a socialist country, not just with the welfare state, but nationalized industries, strong unions, and it really was a different world. It wasn't all that long ago, but it feels, the important thing to me is it feels a long time ago.
But you had milk before you had then you orange squash, though. Lots of things changed in the schools.
Well, that's another one of my socialist poems. I describe kindergarten where we would. Thanks to the socialist government, we would all get a lovely glass of milk at lunchtime or break time. And it was one Mrs. Thatcher, who was then the education minister, who took that away.
Oh, so let's hear it.
Would you like that? That's
no,
not,
any socialist poem you've given.
This is the first one. This is socialist poem number one.
Right.
And the subtitle of this is England, the Winter of Discontent, 1978. Mm-hmm. To 79. That was the year that the strong unions all decided to strike during you know, tough economic period, and that's really what brought down the last English socialist government. This is meant to be in a voice of the young person I was then. I am seven and see things simply as a fish does. I can see the flat colours of the 1970s, greens, browns, cold greys like fading Kodachrome. I see the unburied of the gravediggers' strike, the bat-black mortuaries crawling with terror, and monsterish heaps of uncollected trash bags, evil-smelling, pulling snow into their black folds as if they're pantomime villains making off with the hero. All day scavenging seagulls squawk in a festering sky. Evenings, the sounds of crisis mix with the smell of frying fat, pungent Polish coal. On TV, I watch Mr. Callahan sing, "I'm the man who waters the workers' beer" at the Labour Party conference. Later, he's beetling from number 10 in his shiny black Bentley. Socialists. Their winters as cold and harsh as nylon sheets. At 6:30, electricity's cut off, the union on a 3-day week. So we sit in the kitchen while Mum smokes her thin cigarettes and Grandma's reminded of the war. Hazy blue light from the gas stove throws crazy shadows against the wall. Doom dark drifts against the house, an awful reverse snow. Above the rattle of boiling spuds, my transistor radio speaks a strange tongue. Tripartite bargaining, arbitration, it trills. 7 o'clock. Soon Dad'll be home, hair slick from snow drizzle. No shower till the heater growls awake. 9:30. I fold icy sheets around me, keeping the curtains open. The moon glows like a pilot light. All winter, I've watched filaments of ice lay down shapes in the corner of the window. A spaceship, a fabulous continent, a rose. Tonight, a hand sets out. It grows into one of Grandpa's big, bony hands. Only it grows bigger than that, more scary, pain after pain in its clutch.
Terrific. You know, how poetry is better than journalism. We learn so much more of the news in it. And I say you're going to give adjectives a good name. You are the adjective king.
Well,
and hyphenated words, too. I mean, you're bringing them back into style.
Yes, it's a part of my craft. This is something I not only learned from my teachers at Purdue, Marianne Baruch and Tom Andrews, and Neil Myers, who really saw that I...
They helped?
They saw that I had, well, maybe not even a talent, but I just loved making metaphors. And so they pushed me. And they told me to read some of the great poets that are still writing today who are metaphor makers. I think Charles Wright is the most important influence for me there.
But you get more bang from a line than anyone I know right now. Does anyone bring up Dylan Thomas to you?
Funnily enough, no.
Why not? When I read the density, mm-hmm. which was so intricate and so detailed and so well developed, it brought back Dylan Thomas
much. I think I'm so influenced by Dylan Thomas. I barely even read him anymore. I've just absorbed. I would if I was to flatter myself, I'd love to sort of place myself within the line of late romantics that really Dylan Thomas took up.
Let me do it for you then, because I saw that in the line, mm-hmm. and I thought, I bet people say that to him, and so I'm mm-hmm. very surprised that they don't.
No.
And also, are you Welsh? I mean, is there Welsh in you?
It's funny you should say that. My mother has recently found that we have Welsh, and her family has Welsh ancestry, so she's very... She'd be very happy to hear.
It's seeping through. Absolutely.
Well, but there are other English and also Irish poets who, again, so I say so influenced because, of course, I was lucky enough to read them at college and study them at college without really studying their craft so much. But of course, Seamus Heaney, especially his first book, and funnily enough for me, especially with my, let's say, my politics and my social views, Philip Larkin is an enormous influence. Partly because he is, I would say, even more than those, even more than Dylan Thomas and Seamus Heaney. He's a master craftsman.
Yes, but I think you sound more like Thomas.
Yeah. And with my accent?
No, I think it's with your hyphenated words.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the way you juxtapose adjectives.
Must be an Anglo-Saxon thing. But I also read a lot of European poets. Thomas Tranströmer, the Swedish poet, is a big influence on me. French poets, obviously. In the original, but you know, obviously in translation as well, like Francis Ponge. The detail you've mentioned, but also the way the metaphors are built,
mm-hmm.
And the use of the sort of hyphenated adjectives is all a way of creating metaphors in ways that are more interesting than just saying like this, like that.
It's using layers and layers and layers.
Yes.
Very rich, intricate.
Well,
and
as soon
rich.
as you decide you're going to describe objects and make metaphors in ways other than simply using a simile, which is what a lot of young poets do, then your language naturally becomes richer because you have to use more of the language. Adjectives, verbs become metaphors.
And do you know what I call it? Energy. Because when I read your book, and I had my little stick'em note by me in bed, and I'm scribbling what I thought, I write mm-hmm. energy, 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 energy mm-hmm. for every poem, because that's what's under the line. If you didn't have that, mm-hmm. you couldn't line all those babies up. Mm-hmm. So let's hear some more. This is Martin Walls, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress.
Well, this is a poem. As I said, I like to write about wider subjects, history, politics, but also concentrate sometimes on objects and animals. And this is from my first book, Small Human Detail in Care of National Trust, and this is a poem called Cicadas at the End of Summer. Cicadas at the end of summer whine as though a pine tree is bowing a broken violin, as though a bandsaw cleaves a thousand thin sheets of titanium. They chime like freight wheels on a Norfolk Southern slowing into town. But all you ever see is the silence. Husks glued to the underside of maple leaves. With their 1950s Bakelite lines, they'd do just as well hanging from the ceiling of a space museum. What cicadas leave behind is a kind of crystallized memory, the stubborn detail of the shape around a life turned the color of forgotten things, a cold broth of tea and milk in the bottom of a mug, or skin on an old tin of varnish you have to lift with lineman's pliers, a flypaper that hung 30 years in Bird Cooper's pantry in Brighton.
Martin Walls, that was Small Human Detail in Care of National Trust. And now we need to talk a little bit about the tiny creatures that have invaded your psyche, and you've made deities of little bugs. I think that Ted Kooser has met his match, because you will spend an hour looking at a centipede. Or what is it that allows you to make that tiny creature such a metaphor?
Oh, well, I think it's those sorts of poems started out as ways for me to become more serious as a poet. And to become more serious as a poet, you need to, I think, have a lot more attention to the details of the world.
And you did that purposely.
I did it purposely. In fact, a poem like Cicadas at the End of Summer, I could say would be a sort of a student piece that I decided... coming from England, I'd never seen a cicada before. So they're naturally incredible, and their little shells they leave behind when they molt, which litter in Lafayette in Indiana, where I went to graduate school, they litter the sidewalks in late summer. And so I just decided to sit down with it one day.
Give us another.
Poem. Well, I'll read another little bug poem. This one is called Pill Bugs from my book Commonwealth. And again, this is... an act of pure concentration. And really, this is the deep influence on these poems as well is the French poet Francis Ponge, who wrote I believe is one of the greatest books of poetry in the 20th century, and with a beautiful title I wish I could steal, called On the Side of Things.
I am going to go check it out.
It is, and he really writes about small things, bugs, and it was just when I first read those poems, I suddenly realized, wow, you could, you know, it was the
what
world in a grain
do.
Of sand idea of William Blake, of course. And so I decided to copy that impulse, but with an English sensibility and American bugs. Pill bugs, these, in England we call these wood lice. These are the bugs, as you'll hear in the poem, the ones that crawl along and you touch them and they roll up, and they sort of live in soil and wood. A convex length of desiccated spruce bark beside the herbs to catch pests. A detached cuff of wood loosened by disassembling heat. I stand in the half-naked shade and peek beneath the trap to see what's mustard. Snails glued in a row like leather buttons. Earwigs on a slick journey out of the deep past. Pill bugs, the colour of tempered steel, simple, beautiful as a first invention, the cam wheel, block and tackle, Archimedes screw. They gladden my heart, their few well-turned parts, the clicks, the neat fit with eternity, like great poetry. Insects, don't weep. Even stars grow apart. To speak clearly, the dictionary says, is articulate, which is also to be built with several joints. These pill bugs walk easy on their comma feet, as if on grease. Back plates slide straight to curve smartly as baggage carousels. And they've one more trick. I touch one and quick, it curls up tight as a bearing, a fortress, a cannonball. So cinched, Dad used them to play marbles before the war when pennies pinched. When the word articulate is furled, we're left with art. I swill them round the spruce bark, then watch them open, iron petals. Watch as they start moving round the pieces of a dream.
What is that wonderful line? When the world articulate is furled,
we're left with art.
We're left with art. Now, did that come first, and then it came out of that poem? You didn't have that.
No, that came
written
out
on the back of your bedpost.
No, that was poem's just sort
came.
Of, you know, created itself. Really.
Now here's what they say about him. Philip Memmer says this, spiders and moths, fireflies and centipedes, and each of us as well, are the residents of Martin Wall's Commonwealth, a gorgeous new anthill of a book that evokes, page by page, the holy yes of boys who stare in wonder. Wall's invertebrates are rendered with startling detail, and it's upon that simple lives, as one spider reminds us, that he's built his philosophy. And he says this very, very well, because you are praising nature at the same time changing it. So I'll never look at one of those things again without thinking it's glorious.
That's really
what you've done.
One of the things a poet ought to do, I think.
It's a simple thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All things that grow or crawl, Martin Walls has blessed. We would like to hear some more.
Harvestman Spider. The harvestman spider, arbiter of suspension, thinks, I've dug this trench to test her. Now she's bouncing through the cilantro bed. To her, a forest of lace and spice. Smooth motion. Her body, a drop of axle grease covered in lint, which at first seems held aloft by sleight of hand, perhaps magnetic levitation. The truth's just as incredible. Those legs, as fine as the needles on a seismograph, they track the slightest vibration, even this poem.
Martin Walls, I'm Grace Cavalieri at the Library of Congress, and we will tell you that he is the Witterbinner Fellow for this year, chosen by the United States Poet Laureate. And we're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have another book in the making. I bet you do have something in your...
Yes, it takes a long time.
In your bottom drawer. How many pages are into that?
I've written... a book for me is often a case of writing a lot of poems, going in a new direction, then sitting back and trying to shape what I have, cutting a lot of things, moving a lot of things.
But you think
later.
Book as you're writing.
Well, yes, I guess I do. Actually, I tend to think series of different kinds of poems, like the socialist poems.
Yes.
I have these, you know, and then I might decide I'd like to add to my little bug poems, if you like. And then, so I tend to sort of little piles of these series, these little, these different projects I have going.
But it gives us unity. I like that. It gives us
well,
a
I
unified...
Well, I hope. That's what I try to do. Now, that's again, something that my teachers in my MFA program taught me how to do, was how to take raw material and shape it into a book. And lots of different kinds of poems, especially my first book, Small Human Detail, that had to be quite carefully crafted, because there were history poems and political poems and bug poems and people poems. And I had to, my job there was to create an organic whole.
And what we get is your autobiography, your emotional autobiography. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty miraculous, I think. So let's have another poem.
Well, I will read one of the poems that Phil Memmer is a good friend of mine who directs the Writer's Voice program at the downtown YMCA in Syracuse. And I asked him to write one of the... they call them blurbs.
Yeah, I don't like that word, do you?
No, but it is...
Let's
no one knows
them,
what else to...
I know.
They're meant to be to be mini-reviews.
Yeah, so maybe commentaries.
Commentaries, mini-reviews. This is a poem called Reformation. And this, again, is from Commonwealth. It is fall in the woods. I go in. A downed aspen is covered in ears. To what is it listening? Crack of crisp leaves as I bend to them, the thrill of late cicadas, a distant grackle testing the season with its pulse of song. And something else, more feeling than sound, this light, branch sifted, granular, as if seen through a grill. The sun's brass screw tightens. Cold places its shawl on my shoulders. Slowly dropping leaves reveal vaulting boughs and vast limestone clouds. Orb spiders have pinned web theses to the trunks of ash and beech. Upon our simple lives, they claim, you've built your philosophy.
You have been compared to Elizabeth Bishop and Gerard Manley Hopkins for detail. But I want to compare you to Hopkins for the sprung line.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, you know that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Oh, so you feel
another,
you're influenced.
Another great. Thankfully, my mentor at Purdue, Marianne Baruch, is a great fan of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And his sprung line helped me create music in my poetry without feeling I had to be an old-fashioned metrical poet, I'm not the sort of poet who can just write a line without any kind of prosody in it, partly because I think that's the English influence. I just grew up with strong writers of prosody, people like Dylan Thomas.
You were born, though. I think your brain's wired that way. You did not lead us to believe that you came from a literary family.
No,
hardly.
Well, I mean,
not really.
No, but
average middle class.
Yes, my father was a civil servant, and my mother was a homemaker. Obviously intelligent people, but middle class in any way.
But poetry, with your drive and your passion, that sounds like it came from another world.
Well, it
your love, which was so early shown.
Well, I didn't really start to read poetry seriously until I was about 16 or 17.
But you talk about being younger and the memories and the reveries you bring to your present life from youth were harbored then.
Oh,
as
yes,
a poet.
But that was all really not a literary upbringing, but actually a sort of an upbringing as a craftsman. See, I feel very strong in my family. Their background is. Certainly my father's family, his father, his father's father, and so on, they're all master craftsmen. And my father even was the first to go to college and have a job, sort of a clerk's job, civil servant job. But he's a gardener, a carpenter. In fact, that's what he's done in his retirement, has become a carpenter for a preservation railroad.
It all shows up.
And he taught me how to use tools. Now, I'm not particularly adept at anything. I garden, I can't, but I'm not very good gardener, I'm not a very good carpenter, but I think it's the craft.
Learning how things get put
together. I don't think
there's
any, you see, that I'm one of those people who just simply thinks that, you know, once you're a craftsman, you're a craftsman. And then if you're a carpenter, that's, you know, you use the ability there. Let's say I became a musician, you know, I play drums, but again, not very well, but I may, you know, a musician or a poet, they all have the sort of same level and love of craft, which is a love of detail, a love of patience, a life of the mind that all comes with that. My great-grandfather's a working man doesn't mean he wasn't an artist.
Well, we're talking about character, too, and qualities. Oh, yeah. So I think that shows up. And we're so glad to meet it head on. Martin Walls, I'm Grace Cavalieri at the Library of Congress. And we would like to hear some more. I feel there's so much affirmation in your work. And so much saying to the world, yes.
I would like to read a poem about, I live in Syracuse, New York now. And
do you like it?
Yes, I do. Very long winters, and that's what I'm going to read about.
Cold.
It's cold. It's winter lasts about 6 months. And sometimes we have ice storms. And ice storms are fascinating. I've written about them twice. In fact, there's two poems in Commonwealth called Ice Storm. One about an ice storm I experienced in Purdue, while I was at Purdue. And this one, which I call Ice Storm 2 because it's the second ice storm poem, is about one in Syracuse, New York. I wake at 5 in the morning to a chapel dawn, the sun's low sputtering wick rays blinds on my neighbour, the just married daughter of Solveig's mayor, standing at her porch window, cupping coffee, staring, searching, I imagine, for something beyond the thin grasp of words. Later, I step into a steady rain, shaken from the sky as if from a sieve, a light shifting sound at the edge of the spoken. I see the twigs of the buckthorn have become mother's jeweled fingers cutting butter in the dough, and I am 4 again. Ice-heavy branches stuck in the powdered snow are vanilla beans in her sugar jar, a flavour I taste on the wind. The spiritual, I say, but she's gone. My neighbour, I mean. The spiritual is an act of memory, image, ice hooked to image, till all's connected.
Martin Walls, we're at the Library of Congress. Under the pressure of language, a line can often break, but it never breaks under yours. You have a buoyancy under that. What do you think when you figure very ordinary parents have us very ordinary kids, and mm-hmm. one will wind up being a CPA and the other will wind up being a poet? Mm-hmm. What do you think is that about? I think that we just come that way, right?
Yes, it may be. Looking back, it's funny because one would think maybe with my sort of love of language that I was very sort of verbal and writing a lot as a young kid, and a little bit, but not, you know, not, I didn't really stand out.
Incubating?
Yes, probably. Mm-hmm. As I say, it was probably incubating, doing other things, like helping my dad
yes.
in the garden, helping,
yes.
you know. Helping my, I was going to say helping my mum in the kitchen, but I think she would.
That was a lie. You caught yourself before you lied.
Yes.
Okay.
Sometimes helping my mother in the kitchen.
Let's have another poem. That we know is the truth.
Yes. This one is another Syracuse poem. This is a poem about Syracuse in the spring, because after all that winter, when spring comes, it's an awesome thing, which is nice. Well, that's one of the nice things. You have four seasons there, very distinctive. And that, I think, helps connect people to the world in a way that I don't think I would sort of get if I lived, let's say, in Florida, a place where there are much fewer seasons. This is called Bottleneck Blues. Sunset pours a glass of lager as a froth of frog song drifts up from Geddes Creek. The murmur of a slow commute from the valley. Red wing blackbirds from the meadow, mouths heavy with song and straw. Beneath the dog rose, slugs brim after the brief rain. Slim grass swooning beneath the weight of this first kiss, as she did when we did, among the shingle and bladderwrack of Rottingdean Beach. Everything shone then. Hard flint washed bright black in the backswash. Herring gulls clean lifted from the salt cloud. The rock pools, each jealous world holding fast its own moon. Now a bat bobs on waves of a warm breeze, stirred by twilight from the twilight of its death. How brittle our lives are, buoyed on a tide of what might have been. But on this scale, how tiny the sadness within them, a grain trapped in the arms of sugar maple trees.
Do that Dylan Thomas thing you do. What was that line? Hard flint washed back
bright.
In the... Give me that line.
Hard flint washed bright black in the backswash.
Oh.
That's Gerard Manley Hopkins.
That's gorgeous.
That's
gorgeous.
That's essentially a sprung line.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the craft of that
is... Well, tell us about that.
Well, it's actually, as far as I read it, and I don't want to seem too blasé about it, but I do read him as a poet, not as a literary critic. It's an Anglo-Saxon line in that it's got heavy beats to it.
Right.
But it's not metrical in that old sort of Shakespeare iambic pentameter sense, because as Gerard Manley Hopkins had it, you could create a rhythm with lots of beats in it as long as it had a musical sound to it.
You've got it.
Hard flint wash bright black in the back swash.
God,
there's a lot of beats in there.
That is gorgeous. I'm so glad you identified that line, because that's what I want our audience to hear and know about you. And that is what you will be known for very well. Martin Walls. I'm at the Library of Congress with him. And we like it here. A lot of affirmations in your poetry. Let's have some more.
I'm going to read a poem called Poem for the Magnolias, which is actually, funnily enough, a poem set back home in Brighton, which is not really meant to be a place known for its magnolias, but people grow them there. They're quite hardy trees, which is wonderful, because they're beautiful trees. And this is a poem that's essentially lots of little one-liners about magnolia trees that grew in houses near where I live, my parents' house in Hove in England. And as you'll hear, they were a joy to me in the year after college, where I had not an unenjoyable job, but a sort of a tough job in a liquor store, kind of a boring job. And so I passed these magnolias on the way to work, and they made me happy, and I wrote essentially a memory poem about them. This is Poem for the Magnolias. Magnolias are opening their raw and awkward hearts as if they are about to confess to a perfect crime. Before the magnolia flowers, it was the time of fat, bruised buds. All the cats in Hove Park Road were unapproachable. It's raining. I'm late for work, frustrated. I must be more like the magnolia. The way their petals swell all at once, then overextend, overexcited for life. Is it the curve on magnolia petals that makes the notes of ring doves so round, or vice versa? Every day on my way to the wine store, I see the magnolias. Pleasure more exquisite than my tea break or stealing a pack of Marlboro. A magnolia blooms. The sea is calmed. Fish throw themselves onto hooks. When a magnolia flower unfurls, it lets go a cry inaudible to humans. There should be wine made from magnolia petals, to be drunk, chilled, with quail's eggs and salmon, or duck à la pêche with water chestnuts. The rain-smudged bark of the magnolia, the flowers scattered like lit windows in a dark street. Today, both the sun and moon try to imitate a magnolia flower. Now the magnolias have blossomed, summer can continue. Dr. Dossiter may go on vacation. Mr. White can quit worrying about his tomatoes. A magnolia flower opens in the middle of the evening. Electricity flickers on and off. On my way to work, I remember to take in the magnolias. That evening, I'm 5 pounds up on my till. Steel black woodlice on a magnolia branch, and the roseate moonlight shining on them. Magnolia petals say white, but they mean pink. The Botanical History of Sussex by Gerald Legg does not include the cultivation of magnolias, which do not mind, confident of their influence. I hear laughter coming from the magnolias. A magnolia flower awakens, takes stock of its whereabouts, careful not to speak too harshly. These four trees have bloomed together democratically. When they vote, they all vote for the Magnolia Party. A magnolia bud, its aperture of petals unwinding. The petals of a magnolia flower are simple, lucid, spontaneous, occurring. Preparing to crush the cabbage butterfly, I think of a magnolia petal come alive, and I let it go.
I can hardly believe that poem was written from looking back. How could you occupy that reality from so long ago?
I think I have a good memory.
I think that, and that, I actually do
this,
think so.
This poem came to me all at once as well. It's one
and
of,
that's a long poem.
And it's a long poem. So this is sort of one of those magical things and that
we,
happens.
It is. And more magical than that is we know who you are through that.
Mm-hmm.
Through the opening of every bud, I know who you are. That is the magic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it tells so much.
Yes, and it's and there's a lot in here that's one of there's two influences I'd have to say that helped me write this poem. The first one, another foreign poet, Yehuda Amakai, his poem called "Poem for a Woman," which is one of his early poems, mm-hmm. early love poem, is a long poem on a single subject in sections, short sections. And again, as a student, I read that and I thought, wow, I wish I could do that.
And you did.
And then I think the second influence would be my fellow Witterbinner fellow, Campbell McGrath, who showed me when I read his poems. He's roughly 10 years older than me, so he was already well established.
Did you know his work?
Well, yes, I was lucky enough to be introduced to him, to interview him for the Sycamore Review, which I was the poetry editor of at Purdue. And I knew his work very well. And he was writing about, you know, in a beautifully crafted way, ordinary things.
Absolutely.
Ordinary people, his childhood. In a way, I mean, lots of people do that, but there was something about his matter-of-fact tone of voice, and really, you know, a great poet of Americana in that sort of Whitman,
exactly
Carl
Sandburg. That was exactly the word I
yes.
was going to say, Americana.
And, of course, I can't be that, but I like the idea of me being a poet of Englishiana or whatever that word would be, in the same way as he is. And I think that's what's nice about me having been trained in the States, is I have simply a different... I've got so many more influences that I can absorb. And sort of absorbing an influence of someone like Campbell McGrath and applying it to my own past...
background and your own
ready,
politics,
you know,
and your
yes.
own... You?
As indeed he has. He has written a series of poems called
oh,
The Capitalist
absolutely,
Poems.
Yes.
And, of course, the Socialist Poems were... He tells me I'm allowed to call them a homage to him. But in all seriousness, when I read those, I thought I wanted to write about my past. I didn't know how to do it.
You got the form.
And then, exactly, mm-hmm. I read The Capitalist Poems. I went, oh, this is how you do it. And so that's what I did.
You're teaching our audience how to be fully alive as a writer.
Well, read people and
read,
be influenced by them.
Read.
Yes.
And right now, read yourself, please, because everyone is standing by the radio. This is Martin Walls.
Sitting, I hope.
Well, you know, they could be driving in a car.
That's true.
They could be baking a cake.
In their driveway.
Doing, yeah. But we know they're listening to poetry.
This is a poem called, from my first book, Small Human Detail, called "If There Must Be Faith, Let It Be in Poetry." I'll pray for it. Sunday. Evening simmers. Colours are drained and laid to one side. Dotted light strewn on the vinca as if strained through a colander or leaded windows. From middle distance, church bells of St. Boniface asking why we turned from God, of St. Aquinas wondering what happened to our natural orientation toward the infinite. All around, heroic attempts to settle the old conflict, faith versus reason, kids throw a stolen sneaker high into the silver maple. The shoe becomes a blue jay. Its song is a nail aching from the wood.
You are noticed for your last lines.
Yes.
And I want to double that. I want to emphasize your last lines because I think you care about ending a poem.
Yes, I do put extra effort into my last lines. I sometimes think I'm a little, I don't know, a little
fussy?
Heavy-handed. Well, I wouldn't say fussy.
I don't agree. I think your last lines are masterful. And I think it's very hard to end a poem. I think that's a craft you got from your grandfather that
yes.
put that plant, that bulb, in just exactly in the right square.
Yes.
Yes. And another poem, please.
This is a poem called 1978. At last, a sunny day in Brighton. Glass butterflies are crawling over the houses in our street. Mother throws open leaded lights. Latches pop like old knees. Stiff hinges leave white scales on brick sills. Outside, rain evaporates to slow crystals of tea rose and dog rose. Hydrangeas are slaked. They've the thirst of a priest, my father jokes. The flouncing flowers of Lavateria show like petticoats. I'm standing in the midst, chewing a nasturtium leaf, thinking of all the ways God finds to say yes to us. This is the simplest. Sweepings are emptied in the ash can, daylight beaten into doormats. Today, Mother says, the sun and his white hair will be our guest. She hands me a colander to pick lettuces and raspberries for tea. Behind their nets, vegetables have the gaunt look of prisoners of war. See, I do help my mum. I go and pick the vegetables.
You did. You do. And it doesn't, the sun doesn't shine on a seaside town.
Occasionally.
And people still use the beach? And people
yes,
still use
when
the
it,
beach?
When it's sunny, it's beautiful, but often. 1978 actually is a poem about a year in which it was actually pretty nice.
That's one of your best poems.
Oh,
do you think
nice
so?
Oh,
you can't
know.
Tell.
No,
let's
not really.
Have another. We're on a roll. One thing about you is that you go along and along. Everything in life is just made holy, and then you pop. You give death a bad rap. In a couple of poems, you all of a sudden I come up short with something about death, and I think it's strange because it's also much part of the process you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I think
yes.
there will be poems that will
I
be different about
it's
that.
It's because I'm young. I think, really.
That's a good answer.
I haven't, you know, I. One. I think one of, if I was to say there was a problem with my poetry, I don't think it has the kind of wisdom that it ought to.
Oh no, I do not agree. You know
okay.
what I think wisdom is? I think wisdom is saying the thirst of a priest. You know, and what your
yes.
mother says. I think the dialogue you capture is what is memorable and what we carry away. And I remember after I close the book, and that is wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But but also there's things that, as you said, like my sort of attitude towards death and dying, which I think as a young person, you definitely have a different attitude. 10-20 years from now.
You're not alone.
Well,
let's have
oh,
a poem.
No, I hope. This is a poem called The Rail Shed, and it's set at Sheffield Park in England, which is, as I mentioned earlier, where my father, in his retirement, has volunteered as a carpenter at the Bluebell Railway Preservation Society, which is a steam preservation society. And this is, again, a memory poem about visiting their train museum. It's called The Rail Shed. Midway through, we descended a long ramp and found our shoes buried in a strange mulch. Fire-parched timetables, washers, wrenches, coal ash that crunched, coke that stepped on, chimed like pumice, ripped tea bags loosed spores, and through the ballast sprouted carriage bolts and rivets with awful bloated heads. Dust and dusk grains floated about as though one stirred a glass of sand. Light drizzled through chinks in the corrugated roof. Such stenches were there, creosote, spilt oil, spoiled moon-yellow milk in cracked bowls for skinny cats that slinked along or coiled between split ties. A horrid resin bled from the downed trunks of engines, bile-yellow axle grease, and rust that streaked windows or rimed leaf springs and bow pistons. Who knew what beasts slept in boiler pipes end to end like a seam of bees in a roof beam? What canvas wings unhinged at night to feed upon huge spoked wheels, blossoms of brass and iron? At the yard end, the light was stainless, burning the eyes at first. Rails curved away there, braiding together till they spliced into the branch line proper. In the sun, the polished iron gleamed like rivulets of ice.
Martin Walls, and we will have a final poem.
Exile. How does one show contrition to a city, or reassemble a flotsam of memory untouched by exile's tide slow erasure? And who can say with confidence, 3,000 miles away, that something other than nostalgia explains this ardor for the commonplace? For the burnt crust of close-packed houses atop those hills, the soot-black trees in the salt-soaked air, the sky the color of bleached bone or a cleaned fish, white as knuckles gripping the beach rail hard, for the hush of backwashing waves, barnacles closing calloused eyes, seaweed clutching wet fists of stone, for fishing boats chained above the storm beach, the sea's mixture of milk and glass, from which, in summer, divers would emerge, pulling their face gear off as if Brighton were a new world, safe to breathe. They'd lay their gifts on the table, rusted buckles, frosted bottles, crusted coins, oil cans, playing cards, a message calling with its distant voice, "If you find this, please return my note." The door of the sea had cracked open.
That is the voice of Martin Walls, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media, post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.